May it please the Court, my name is Carrie Connor and I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Mosley. The sole issue before the Court, though there is some issue, is whether it would be under Rule 32, under fundamental unfairness, Your Honor, is the overall fundamental fairness of his supervised release hearing. In this case, the Court permitted the government to submit a DVD of a statement from a witness that claimed that Mr. Mosley had sold her cocaine. Mr. Mosley had, at the outset of the proceeding, and actually sometime before the proceeding, had notified the court of his intention to admit to a grade B violation, which was possession of cocaine. The hearing proceeded. The government put a police officer on the stand who, through the police officer and over the objection of counsel, introduced the DVD of a woman by the name of Cheryl Simmons. Your Honors, in this case, the defense objected very specifically seven times.
But the basis, Ms. Connor, was Crawford and confrontation, right?
Your Honor, actually, over the period of time, and including the time period when before the court had rendered a decision, words reliability were used, hearsay was used, trustworthiness, credibility, and Crawford.
But no reference to Rule 32 or due process?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the word due process was actually used, but certainly all of the words surrounding the objections went to the concept of reliability.
So you don't agree we're here on plain error?
I don't agree, Your Honor. I don't agree.
Do you lose if we're here on plain error?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said it. You don't agree that it's plain error.
I did. I was moving on. You don't agree. I get that. But do you feel you lose under plain error?
Absolutely not. I think it's important to look at the three primary cases that we have in the Seventh Circuit on this issue. At the time that the opening brief was filed in this case, those two cases were Pratt, which was decided in 1995, and Kelly, which was decided much more recently. Both of those cases actually discussed fundamental fairness in the context of reliability and trustworthiness. Certainly the objections that were made at the time of the supervised release hearing were broader than that. But in fact, the objections made reflected the law on the books at the time regarding issues specifically to be addressed by the court in determining whether untested hearsay would come in and to what extent it would be considered. In the interim, we have the decision of Jordan. And Jordan obviously rests on Rule 32, but in all fairness, having reviewed the briefs in that case and the opinion, Rule 32 was never mentioned by Jordan in the supervised release hearing. However, again, conceptually, the court determined that there was enough there to address the issue under Rule 32. The same is here, Your Honor. Absolutely. We've used the words that were necessary to make the objections at the time. Certainly, I wish I had said the magic word Rule 32, but I did not. What I think is very important for the court at this time is to continue the progression of the supervised release analysis for district courts. In this case, though there was a substantial discussion and great clarity to the court about the defense's objection and specifically concerns about the reliability of the hearsay, the trustworthiness of the hearsay, the credibility of the declarant, the court ignored all of that and simply found by the preponderance of the evidence without any type of discussion at all. If we were to look to Pratt and we were to look to Kelly, Pratt actually was decided before Rule 32 came to be in 2002. Those cases do, in fact, rest significantly on reliability and trustworthiness. But both in Pratt and in Kelly, we had a non-present declarants who were actually victims of an offense. In Pratt, we had a woman who claimed that she had had her mail stolen, and I believe additionally a second victim who gave a statement that had not received his mail. Clearly victims. In Kelly, we have two people who claim to have been the victims of a battery and to have seen a firearm. In both of those cases, there's very little issue that the non-present declarant is trustworthy, credible, or has any reason to tell a falsehood. Entirely different than the case at bar. We actually have a woman who the only observation by the police officer is, frankly, a white woman getting into a black man's car quickly, and it appeared to him that there could have been something, he says, a drug deal done, though he sees nothing exchanged, he sees no packages, he sees no money.
He sees an expression on her face of alarm or something like that when he drives
Absolutely.
By, and then she quickly exits the car, and then shortly after that, she turns over to him, four bags of cocaine? Okay.
Well, an hour later, she turns over four bags of cocaine
and crack pipe of some sort.
She does. But there's no search of her house. There's no discuss. There's no. We don't know what else was there. She was not in the house. She was found walking back from a store. The point is that yes, maybe the officer had suspicion to believe that something occurred in that car, but to conclude that Mr. Mosley was the seller and the woman he spoke to was the buyer, as opposed to her being the buyer and possibly Mr. Mosley being the seller, is entirely based on Cheryl Simmons' testimony.
Well, there's also some additional direct corroborating evidence in what was found in Mr. Mosley's car. I mean, drugs and $400 in cash was found in his car.
Well, interestingly, though Mr. Mosley has cash on him, we don't know what Ms. Simmons has on her because she's actually not searched, and she had gone to the store in between.
Yeah,
obviously
not,
had money at that point.
But we're not in a proof beyond a reasonable doubt where if the evidence, you know, is reasonably interpreted in a variety of ways, the judge is entitled to interpret this as a drug deal with Mr. Mosley as the dealer, based on what he heard from the officer, you know, without regard to
I would disagree. It's entirely supposition. It's entirely supposition based on what Ms. Simmons had to say. The cocaine that was found in Mr. Mosley's car, which he admitted to possessing, was not in the same packaging as the drugs that Ms. Simmons provided. Ms. Simmons had four bags of cocaine. Mr. Mosley had one. Mr. Mosley...
He didn't have any crack smoking implements, no pipe, no other means.
In the car?
Right.
In the car, there doesn't appear to be, but there was
but
no
she
discussion.
Does. She does.
In her house.
Right.
In her house. I wonder.
Wouldn't one infer she's the user from that?
She's a user, yes. I think we could assume that. We don't know what's at Mr. Mosley's house. The point is that it's quite clear from the record that the officer in this case told Ms. Simmons, and he admits to this, she basically wasn't going to be prosecuted. If she'd come down and make a statement, he wouldn't tell her mother about this. He drops her off at a distance so her mother doesn't know about this incident.
It's still an admission against her interest, isn't it? Even though he's giving her a pass, it could have been used against her.
I think there's very little difference between her statement and a statement in Bruton that would be someone has just been arrested and says, oh, I'm just a user, he did it. We know black letter law for decades is those are unreliable statements. I'd like to save a little time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Ms. Cheng Adiga.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jennifer Cheng Adiga on behalf of the United States. In this case, Your Honor, I believe, had asked about the relevant objections that Mr. Mosley's counsel made below during the revocation hearing. And as the record indicates, Mr. Mosley's attorney did object to Simmons' hearsay statements coming in, and those objections were based on hearsay, Crawford, and at one point, yes, reliability. And that was the extent of the objections. There was no objection based on due process, nor, as she concedes, was there an objection based on Rule 32.1 B2C of the rules, of criminal procedure. I'll start with the defendant's claim under Rule 32.1b2c. It's the government's position that Mr. Mosley has waived this claim based on the fact, as I just discussed, that he did not raise an objection to the rule below.
How would that be waiver? Wouldn't that just be forfeiture, which we could review on plain error?
Your Honor is correct. I guess it would be
make
waiver.
An explicit statement that I don't raise this under Rule 32.1.
I guess it would be waiver under the fact that the government has also pointed out that Mr. Mosley, although he mentions Rule 32.1 in his opening brief, it's an undeveloped argument. And in that sense, it is, in the government's position, a waiver because it is an undeveloped argument. His opening brief structures his claim as a due process claim, and it's only in his and there's no argument based on the rule. And that's different from the Jordan case because, as this court pointed out in Jordan, although similarly the defendant did not raise a Rule 32.1 claim below, the government in that case did not argue waiver as we're doing here. And also in Jordan, the defendant squarely raised his 32.1 claim on appeal, which he has not done here. Now,
of course, the opening brief was filed before the Jordan case came out, right?
That's true. That's true, but that doesn't change the fact that he did not object on, you know, did not raise that.
Does it really make much difference? I mean, because Rule 32.1 is largely a codification of the due process Morrissey rule, right? So we're going to analyze the issue one way or the other, either under the construct of the rule or under the as a constitutional claim.
I agree with that statement, obviously. I do believe that although it is largely a codification, that there are two separate issues for the court to consider. I do believe that whether it's analyzed under the rule or under the Fifth Amendment due process constitutional claim, that the government does prevail because it's not reversible error in either extent. Now, as to the government's belief that plain error is the appropriate standard of review, we know from looking at the record that the district court did not engage in the balancing test that is now required as laid out in the U.S. v. Jordan case. However, it's our position that Mosley has not established that that's reversible error because he cannot show that the outcome probably would have been different had the error not been committed. In this case, even if you take away all of the hearsay evidence, you are left with quite a bit of evidence that, under this applicable standard, does show that Mosley committed the violation at issue. What do we have? We have the officer's observation, based on his training and 7 years of experience, that he saw Mosley and Simmons engage in what he believed was a drug deal.
But who's the pitcher, who's the catcher? You know, sometimes the dealer gets into the car, sometimes the dealer comes in the car.
That's a good point.
He doesn't give any evidence that shows why, in this instance, he thought Mosley was the dealer.
I think in this instance, what shows that Mosley was the dealer was the fact that in addition to crack, he had a large amount of money on him, $300 to $400, and which no smoking paraphernalia, additionally. And what shows Simmons was the user was that in addition to the crack, she had smoking paraphernalia, not only a crack pipe that she turned over.
As Connor points out, though, we don't know how much money she had.
That's true, we don't, but I do think that it's important to note that
she's got the larger quantity at that point.
She does, but she does have multiple items of the paraphernalia for smoking, which is indicative of a user in addition to the...
It is packaged differently, right?
It's packaged in different color baggies.
But we don't know how that drug, how that cocaine relates to the other cocaine. We don't know whether it's the same consistency. We don't know anything about the drugs other than that they're both cocaine.
Other than they're both crack cocaine, that's correct, because the drugs taken from Ms. Simmons that she allegedly bought from Mr. Mosley were not analyzed, nor were they analyzed.
They could be tested to determine whether the diluents are the same and whether it's the same percentage of cocaine and so forth.
They could have been.
But they weren't.
That's correct. But in addition to all the evidence that I do believe points to the fact that Ms. Simmons was the user and Mr. Mosley was the dealer, The observation that he made of what he presumed to be a drug deal, I think, is one factor in the mix that should be taken into consideration. And based on all of those factors of evidence, it's not necessarily, obviously, enough for proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but the standard we're operating under for a supervised release hearing is a preponderance of the evidence standard. And I do think there's no reasonable probability that the district court, using just the non-hearsay evidence, would not be able to find that it's more likely than not that Mosley committed the violation that he distributed crack cocaine. Now, the due process Fifth Amendment argument, I do believe that that's also not reversible error in this case in light of United States v. Kelly. Even though the district court did not make a good cause finding for Simmons' absence in this case, the hearsay did bear what Kelly calls substantial indicia of reliability, because there was a high level of independent corroboration for the evidence in this case. Here we not only have the officer testifying to Simmons' hearsay statements, but we also have a videotape statement that Simmons made, which largely corroborates her earlier statement to the officer. And we have, as already discussed, the officer's personal real-time observations as well as the physical evidence that was found. And so it's our position that the hearsay in this case bears at least as much, if not more, reliability than the hearsay did in Kelly. In Kelly, the officer who testified about the witness's out-of-court statements was able to make after-the-fact observations, which included the fact that one of the witnesses had a broken front tooth and then also found the gun in Kelly's car. As this court did in Kelly, the record is sufficiently clear in this case for the court to conclude that the hearsay was substantially trustworthy. And, Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Conner. You've got a minute left.
Thank you. First, I'd like to clarify that the government doesn't allege waiver as to the due process claim. They allege waiver based on good cause, which is the language that is pulled out of Rule 32 discussion. I do think it's important, however, to emphasize once again that in Kelly, we're talking about the officer who's testifying has actually seen the physical damage done to the witness as well as having recovered the gun. There's no basis in either Kelly or Pratt to conclude that the declarants who are not present have any basis not to be telling the truth. Clearly, this witness, Cheryl Simmons, does have a significant basis to not be credible. If we remove Cheryl Simmons from the equation, there is absolutely no basis to conclude that, in fact, certainly by the preponderance of the evidence, that Mr. Mosley was selling drugs. And ultimately, I think this is important to conclude, Your Honors, to look at this case closely to give the district court instruction on how these cases should be handled. The district court that decided Kelly also decided this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Conner. And our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Ms. Conner, you were appointed for this representation?
I am.
The court thanks you for your service to your client and the court. And that concludes today's call. The court will be in recess.